accession number 28351, reel 16.
Lord Peter Blaker, reel 15. Could I now ask you about your relationships or meetings that you would have had or contacts with the Russians? This would be Russian leaders or any of the Russian ministers during your time in the Foreign Office or in Parliament.
The only member of the Politburo that I met was Khrushchev, and this was in 1963. When I was a member of the British delegation to the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. This was the first Nuclear Test Ban Treaty ever. And we went to Moscow. The Americans and the British and the Soviet Union were the three countries involved. We were received by Khrushchev, who gave a big party in St. George's Hall. Was in great form, very jolly, shaking hands with everybody. And what I remember vividly was the brightness and the smartness of St. George's Hall, which quite obviously it had a spring clean or whatever. And you saw on these wonderful Rococo columns in the hall all the Russian battle honors in gold, recently regilded, I think. The Russian victories, of course, as opposed to the Russian losses. And Khrushchev was very chatty. I had a brief talk with him, not about anything particularly important politically. And this was against a background of the Red Army band playing Selecting from South Pacific, which I thought was rather amusing and actually quite a good choice to please the Americans and please the British too. Otherwise, the people I met most were called Sirapkin and Zorin. And this was at the nuclear test ban discussions, negotiations which went on, still going on now, started in March 1962. Much changed, many more countries involved. At that time there were only 18. And Sirapkin was the resident ambassador of the Soviet Union in Geneva, where these talks took place. And we had embarked on a program which involved meeting every day from Monday to Friday, which was absolutely crazy, because it didn't give enough time for one to think between Monday's meeting and Tuesday's meeting and so on. And really what one's got to do if anything significant happens is to weigh it up and calculate it and see what the implications are. Anyway, we went at it like a bull at a china shop. And Sirapkin, who was a senior ambassador, I suppose, of that sort of standing, he did all the speaking for the Soviet Union in the early stages. He was an extraordinary-looking man. He had very prominent bones above his eyes. I forget what one calls those bones. It gave him rather a fearsome impression. He was absolutely obdurate, and he basically had one speech for a year, which got very tedious, especially several times a week. And he would occasionally attempt to give a new impression by putting the end of the speech at the beginning and so on, swapping around different parts of the speech, but basically it was the same speech all the time. Until there was a visit by a man called Zorin, who was very senior, and he had been the man who engineered the coup in Prague in 1948. So he was a skilled, experienced operator in repression. And he came out, and very soon after that, Sirapkin began to make a different speech. And so all the other 17 delegations looked at one another with wild surmise, saying, comparing notes, is this a different speech? How extraordinary. And this was the breakthrough. And so the Soviet Union had obviously decided, after a year's attempt to wear us down, that they, if they wanted an agreement at all, which they did, clearly, that they'd got to be reasonable. So that was Sarapkin. Zorin, as I say, came out to the disarmament conference. He was, did I say he was the man who engineered the coup in Prague? I did, yes. He also represented the Soviet Union at the Security Council of the United Nations when the discussion on the Cuban Missile Crisis was underway. And he came out from Moscow to New York. And there was a meeting in the Security Council, which I was lucky enough to attend, where Adlai Stevenson, who had been a presidential candidate in the United States, was the American representative. And Zorin, when he came to speak, said, in effect, this is all poppycock. People are alleging that we have missiles in Cuba trained on the United States. There's no basis for such terrible allegations. Whereupon, Adlai Stevenson gave instructions for a cover to be removed from the great blackboard affair, which was at one side of the Security Council room. And there were photographs of the Russian missiles in Cuba. So, collapse of Zorin. Everybody was very pleased to see the collapse of Zorin, apart from the Soviet delegation, because of his record. He was a very tough man. If there was a very nasty job to be done, he did it. Now, you asked about Gorbachev, I think. I didn't meet Gorbachev. I would have enjoyed very much doing so. He deserves a place in history of importance, because he was the leader who saw, to put it bluntly, that the game was up, that the Soviet Union could not go on competing with the United States in the military field. And I think we discussed what the effect of that on the Soviet Union was, and he saw it. And he concluded that the Soviet Union could never match the Americans in the Star Wars league. And so when Margaret Thatcher said, this is a man I can do business with, she was absolutely right. He didn't last very long as leader of the Soviet Union, which I thought was a pity, but he was, of course, not popular with some of the new thinkers in the Soviet Union because he was still a communist. Communism was going out of fashion with them, with the majority. Yeltsin, for example. But Gorbachev made the breakthrough. So he deserves a very important place.
I suppose Margaret Thatcher did see that, didn't she, when he came?
Well, I suppose, yes, I don't know the details. She had talks with him, long talks. And I infer that it must become clear to her that here was a man who wasn't just mouthing platitudes or allegations that were familiar from the Soviet Union, but was thinking new thoughts. I think that's probably what she meant, but I have no inside knowledge.
Did he come across as somebody very different from the previous Soviet leaders?
Mm, oh, yes.
You said you didn't meet him, but I expect you saw him, didn't you?
I don't think I actually saw him in the flesh. No, I saw him on television. He was a new thinker, yes. I think if one saw him on the television or met him in person, this was new thinking going on. And of course there was new thinking on the American side at the same time. They had this extraordinary meeting in Reykjavik where Reagan, I think, departed from his brief and caused considerable alarm in the American delegation. But that no doubt helped to break the ice.
As you were saying earlier, during another session, how surprised you were with the end of the Cold War, how quickly things collapsed, although you had a pretty good idea, you know, economically, how weak the Soviets were and how much they were spending on the sort of military side. But you said there was surprise that
oh, yes, great.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European empire as well.
That's right. So my forecast when debating with CND is that if the Soviet Union went on competing with the United States in the defense equipment field, they would go bust. That did actually happen, rather to my surprise at the time. I thought it was going to take much longer. I thought it might take up to 20 years. But I lost the thread.
Yes. It really was, you know, the end of the Cold War and how quickly...
Oh, yes, how quickly it occurred. Yes, that's right.
The breakup of the whole empire.
Yes, that's right. it was amazing how quick it was. Mm. As I recall, it began with Hungarians coming across the border where Hungary and Germany met. And once they came across and were not stopped, then other people thought, well, they could do it too. And within a very short time, the Berlin Wall was coming down.
Mm-hmm. German reunification, how big an issue was that? You know, bearing in mind, you know, the past of Germany, how was that regarded, the possibility of the two Germanys coming together? Was that
it had always
desired?
It had always been Western policy. I remember when I was on the EDC desk in the 1950s, 53, 55, that we were in favour of German unification, but of course the Russians occupied the whole of East Germany and wouldn't budge at that time, wouldn't give any impression that they would ever budge. And then the Berlin Wall was built. So when it did happen, it was very surprising to most people. It had been forecast, as I say, for the long term. But the fact that it happened so quickly was amazing to everybody. It was certainly Western policy for many years before it actually happened that Germany should be unified. But of course, by the time it actually happened in 1989, East Germany had been communist, for 40-something years, and so it was deeply embedded. I remember going to East Germany and meeting the Prime Minister there. And it was very bleak. One went across through Checkpoint Charlie in the Berlin Wall and got to a place called the Alexanderplatz. This was in midwinter. It was absolutely bleak. An icy wind sweeping across this empty square, a very big square. And that gave me, I think, a fairly accurate impression of East Germany. But of course, when it did happen, then the question did arise of whether Germany should now be unified. And Margaret Thatcher spoke against it. I think she was mistaken. I don't think we could have gone back on all the efforts we'd made to support unification, because the Germans as a whole, on both sides, would have objected very, very strongly. What I think has gone wrong with unification is the fact that Helmut Kohl, when he was the Chancellor of West Germany, really in charge because East Germany was so weak, when he went for unification on the wrong basis, and particularly with the wrong balance of currencies, he decided that the East mark would be equal to the West mark. Tremendous mistake. Because the productivity of East Germany was minimal compared to West Germany. And therefore, the East Mark should have been worth very much less than the West Mark, and certainly very much less than the figure at which it was put. And that has led to an awful lot of trouble, which Germany is still suffering from. But I suppose Kohl did it for... This is unkind to Kohl, but I think he did it for political reasons, because it was very popular with the East Germans to start with, because they felt a sense of pride that the East Mark was equal to the West Mark. And they didn't foresee, most of the East Germans didn't foresee how difficult it was going to make things for them in the medium term and the long term.
This must have been a very challenging time for not only politicians, but people in the Foreign Office. you know, the way the world was quickly changing after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the unification, reunification of Germany. And of course the formation of far more a plethora of states, weren't there, with the, you know, the countries of Yugoslavia dividing up. How well do you think that was coped with? You know, this was happening so quickly because of all these changes. And I was wondering about the institutions, you know, your knowledge of, say, the UN, and how the UN sort of coped with these changes.
Yes. I remember the word was when the Cold War ended that there was going to be a new world order. Well, there hasn't been a new world order. And one was wrong. People who forecast a new world order were wrong, and quite obviously wrong at the time. And one of the things which has happened is this plethora of little states, now numbering 191 members of the United Nations, which started in 1945 with 51, so almost quadrupled the number of member states, many of them very small states. And what has happened is that many states have suffered from independence movements inside their own territory. And what has struck me, seeing quite a bit of the world in the last few years, is how there is an independence movement in almost every state you can think of. And I may have mentioned earlier that I was responsible for the independence of two lots of Pacific Islands, British colonies, in 1980, each of which, tiny little areas, 12 islands forming one territory, 12 islands forming the other territory. And in each of them, there was an independence movement. Tiny populations, 56,000 in one case, 112,000 in the other, but nevertheless, one island wanting to break away, and usually, in both cases, the biggest island, and the most important, because it didn't want to be subject to domination from the rest of the islands, who they feared were going to get together and be nasty to the big one. And so if you have that sort of situation in those little islands, where you would have thought the people being mostly related racially to one another, though not so in what is now Vanuatu, that is formerly the New Hebrides, but you would have thought that they're being entirely peaceful, very attractive, sunny places, with not much industry, you would have thought there wouldn't be much disagreement, but there was. And we've seen that in Scotland recently. I'm not suggesting they're going to be independent. I hope not, being 3/8 Scots myself. They will pull back. It has existed in Canada for generations. And what one's seeing is all over the place similar independence movements. And this is because there is now no fear on the part of people who want to divide countries that this would lead to a world war. The reason that Yugoslavia survived such a long time, I believe, was largely that it was believed by the people who wanted independence in any one of the six different areas which comprise Yugoslavia, that if they struggled for independence, there might be a repeat of the events of 1914, when the First World War was started by the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke, by a Serb, through political motivation. And only after the end of the Cold War did that fear disappear. So nobody now thinks, and I think they're right, nobody now thinks that a world war is going to be created if you have a trouble in Kosovo or the next Albania or Montenegro or somewhere like that. That's not going to lead to a world war, because the Soviet Union is so weak anyway, and the relations between the West and the Soviet Union, they're not entirely harmonious, nevertheless don't carry any suggestion of a military threat. But I do think the world is going to be a very turbulent place, and I think that we're going to see the sort of troubles we've seen in a continual list of countries. The differences in Iraq now between the Sunnis and the Shias, that was all suppressed when Saddam Hussein was there. And with the disappearance of dictators, we may see more turbulence. I'm not forecasting anything cataclysmic, but I think that the UN's task is going to be more and more peacekeeping, and the question arises, I think, whether it could be peacemaking. There being a very important distinction between the two. So far, it's only been peacemaking. There has been a bit of... it's only been peacekeeping, apart from Kosovo, where there was some peacemaking. But the UN didn't have a role in sanctioning the fighting with Kosovo. It didn't go to the... It may have gone to the UN, but it wasn't approved by the UN. So this sort of thing is going to happen.
What do you think the chances are that the UN can cope with this? You know, there seems to be a lot of problems in the UN at the moment, not least because of the membership of the composition of the Security Council in a very changed world, given the fact that, you know, Europe is now so strong, and countries like Japan, for instance, don't have any presence in the Security Council. Do you think yourself that this needs reforming?
Yes, I do. There's been a very interesting report recently by a committee set up by the Secretary General, which I haven't fully digested. But that is making it clear there have to be radical reforms. And one of the reforms, which seems to be pretty well agreed, and I think that's right, is you've got to have more members of the Security Council, more big and powerful countries from outside as members of the Security Council, the question being, would they all have the veto, or would they be permanent members without the veto? That's a difficult question. One of the other important questions is this question of preemption. In the case of Iraq, there was no second resolution of the Security Council, and that's been a subject of enormous dispute about whether the absence meant that we shouldn't have attacked Iraq, with the Americans and ourselves and others, or whether it was all right, even though a second resolution was not passed, because there were so many resolutions beforehand, which the Iraqi government under Saddam Hussein had ignored and rejected. So you're going to get that sort of problem. It's a very difficult issue, I think, this question of preemption. George Bush has published a document on American strategy which makes it clear that the United States policy is to contemplate preemption. He wasn't particularly concerned about the UN, I think, when Iraq was invaded. He would have done it anyway. So this, I think, is going to be the most difficult problem for the United Nations. When is preemption justified? Is preemption justified in the case of Zimbabwe, where there is terrible trouble, awful things are happening in Zimbabwe? There won't be preemption because the Southern African countries don't seem to mind what Mugabe is doing. Indeed, they rather respect him as a great figure. But I mention that as an example of the sort of thing that might be repeated in the future, where you wouldn't have the same inhibitions against preemption that you have in Zimbabwe. I think that everybody would say that if there's going to be preemption, there must be, if possible, a Security Council resolution. And that would have been very desirable in the case of Iraq. But, of course, the wider question is, what is the future policy going to be? I think it has to be still that Security Council is necessary. Security Council approval is necessary. Very difficult because, and you see it now with the Soviet Union and Russia, in connection with nuclear proliferation, in connection with Korea and Iran. They take a different view from the West view, certainly in Iran. So you've got Russia and China, which on many issues take a totally different view from the West. They are much concerned with their own commercial interests, I think, in both cases. So I don't actually at the moment see how one gets over this problem. What is going to justify preemption in the eyes of the world? It's going to take a lot of working out. And I think what will happen will be that there will be very difficult cases coming up. And what the precedents which are set by the decisions in those cases are going to be extremely influential. So I think there's a lot of unpredictability about what the result is going to be, the resulting decision, the resulting view about preemption.
It's interesting also, you know, what you say about the need for peacekeeping and peacemaking, even more, for getting in before there's the need, I suppose, for preemption.
Yes.
And, you know, I wonder how much debate there is, say, in the House of Lords about the Korean issue. And Iran as well, they're the two major ones, aren't they, at the moment? And your great interest in peace and reconciliation.
They're frequently mentioned, both those cases, mostly at question time. Occasionally we have debates which would touch on this sort of thing, but it's not a matter of every week, although they're enormously important, both examples.
Relationship with the Soviet Union today, you have indicated that you're a little hesitant to say they are, you know, it has changed for really good relations, that there are still problems, not least because there are different perceptions on these issues, you know, like preemption and the UN, how this should be dealt with, and the Security Council. Do you have any concerns about Putin's Russia today?
No. Yes, I do. I think that the transition from communism to the state that Russia is in now was not very well handled at an early stage, because there was such a rush to turn Russia into a free enterprise state that we had all these examples of the oligarchs. That was mishandled, because the rush meant that people who were well placed, who had been senior people in these state industries like telecommunications, oil, energy, and so on, the people who were well placed in those industries in senior positions, very quickly, if they were alert enough, managed to get their hands on an enormous quantity of assets.
End of field 15, Lord Peter Blaker. Lord Peter Blaker.